Pilcher was 8 years old. Her mom left her and her dad. She decided she didn't want to be a mom anymore. And so Jewel and her father moved to their Alaskan homestead, which was way off the grid, and he raised her. Her dad started teaching her to sing, and they started playing out together anywhere they could. They played in veterans clubs and biker bars and honky-tonks, and she learned how to perform and be a singer. When she was 15 years old, her dad's alcoholism and abuse had finally gotten too far, and she left. So she ventured out on her own, finished high school, got a job, an apartment, and started singing anywhere she could. But when she was 18 years old, she lost her job, which eventually led to her losing her apartment. She lived out of her car until her car was stolen, and she found herself homeless for about a year. As if the girl didn't have enough bad luck and bad things, unfair things happening, she had bad kidneys. And she found herself in the parking lot of a hospital almost dying from blood poisoning because the hospital wouldn't see her because she didn't have insurance. Now, it's hard to imagine things getting much worse for anybody. But if you see Jewel today, it's hard to imagine her in these circumstances because she eventually started putting the pieces of her life back together. She got discovered by a producer. She became a platinum-selling recording artist. She's a producer. She's a best-selling author. She sold like over 30 million albums worldwide. And so it's crazy to think about, how did this girl go from being homeless and almost dying to an incredibly successful recording artist, to living on absolutely nothing, to just raking in millions of dollars? I watched this incredible interview that she did this week, and this is what she said. She said, "I am responsible for my own happiness. Nobody can take that from my spirit." She said, "I can't control everything that life does to me, but I can control what it does to my spirit." She said, "No matter how many times I get knocked down, I am going to stand up again." And after facing all of these incredible obstacles, this is what she said. She said, "Loss, pain, struggles, they don't have to make us bitter or damaged. Instead, they have the opportunity to make us more compassionate, more empathetic people." And she said, despite all the success she's had as a musician, when she thinks about her greatest accomplishment, it's not her music, it's not her career. She said, "I can honestly say that my greatest success is my happiness." And it's because she fought really, really, really hard and long for it. And even though life just kept dealing her bad hand after bad hand and was incredibly unfair, she didn't give up. She continued to fight and overcame these incredibly hard life circumstances. And I love hearing about these real life stories of people who, they're not superheroes. I mean, they're no different than you and I, but they just figured out how to look at life, how to take these incredibly unfair, hard circumstances and not ignore them and not act like they don't exist, but they figured out how to move through them and become their best version of who they were supposed to be. They figured out how to get back up, how to fight just a little bit harder and push through to become who they were meant to be. And it's a question we have to ask ourselves. How do we respond when life is unfair? What do we do with the unfairness we experience in our own life or the lives of our loved ones or the things we see happening in the world around us? What do I do? What's my response? What's my go-to reaction when I'm confronted with these unfair realities that just exist? They just are, and I can get angry about them and stomp my feet about them, and I can scream and yell and rail and complain, but it doesn't change them. They're still there. So what's my process, my life process for dealing with these unfairness? And to help us think through these ideas, we're looking at the life of a man called David. David was this man that was chosen by God to be king of his people. God had this chosen people, Israel, that he worked through just in incredible ways, and he called David from being a shepherd boy that nobody looked at to being the guy that led his entire people. And even though David was chosen by God for this incredible task, it didn't mean life all of a sudden just got easy. Like, God picked me, I'm king, roll out the carpet, let's go. David had incredibly hard circumstances he had to overcome just to claim the right he had, the God-given right he had to be king. He had to leave and run for his life when Saul tried to kill him, and he had to live in caves, and the people nobody else wanted to be around, they flocked to David, and he literally had to fight incredible enemies, but he got to be king, and he got to see these incredible things that God was doing, but still he had to face unfairness, and that's the day that came when his own son Absalom tried to kill him. I mean, I've had fractured relationships with people I loved, but nobody's tried to kill me. Can you just imagine the agony of knowing you're on the run for your life because your son, the person you brought into this world, literally wants you to die? And that's an agony that David had to experience. And Absalom got enough people on his side that he actually drove David out of Jerusalem, drove him out of his home, and David took what supporters he had left, and he literally ran out into the wilderness, into the caves, into nowhere, on the run for his life. But Absalom wasn't the only one who turned against him. One of David's trusted advisors was Ahithophel. And Ahithophel turned against David as well. He sided with Absalom and became Absalom's trusted advisor. And it's interesting because this Psalm 4 that we've been looking at, this is David's response to the unfairness, David's response to being on the run for his life when Absalom's trying to kill him. But the rabbis who talk about it, they actually take it a step further and they include this idea of Ahithophel who was siding with Absalom against David. And they say that Ahithophel knew that Absalom was incompetent, knew that Absalom couldn't really be trusted as king, but he still stirred him up against David because his hope was that David would take his advice, which was to eventually rape David's concubines, that he would eventually kill David, and when that happened, Ahithophel would be the one to prosecute Absalom, the city would turn against him, and Ahithophel, then he would get the power and he would be king. So there's just layer after layer after layer of all of this deceit and lies and unfairness that's kind of working against David. His trusted advisor was against him. His son was trying to kill him. And he responds in Psalm 4. And the first thing he says is he prays. He prays to God. He said, "Answer me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You've given me relief when I was in distress. Be gracious to me and hear my prayer." And then the next thing he does is verse 2. Says, "O men, how long shall my honor be turned to shame? How long will you love vain words and seek after lies?" So after David takes this ugliness that's stirring up and the pain and the turmoil and the unfairness of it, he turns to God, he prays to God, he pleads for God's graciousness. And then he asks a question, which is a pretty honest question. How long is this going to last? How long is this going to be this way? Is it temporary? We can all, you know, get ourselves geared up for, okay, 24 hours. I can take 24 hours of anything, right? Like, I can tough it out and I can be strong a month, a week. Or is this just my new life normal? It's just going to be like this forever. He asks God, how long is this going to take? And we've had these questions before, haven't we? We've said to God, how long do I have to put up with this? We've said to God, how long is this going to hurt? We've talked to God and said, how long until this goes away? How long until you show up and make it change? How long until you rescue me? How long until I'm done? Till I just can't take much more. And David asks that. He asks God honestly, how long is this going to take? And after he thinks about how long it's going to be, he turns to thinking about this idea of honor and shame. He thinks about his good name as king and the shame that he feels. And there's something that David recognizes about the unfairness of his current life circumstance that stirs up shame in him. David knew shame. David was an incredible man. God loved him. He loved God. He lived these incredible adventures, but he wasn't perfect. He knew shame, and he carried the weight of life mistakes. He carried the burden of the things that he'd done wrong and the lives that were lost and the innocence that was lost because of him. He carried the shame of having an affair. He carried the shame of murdering her husband. He carried the shame of the child that they lost. And he knew this burden of regret and shame. And you can actually read about David's shame. And he says to God, God, I'm carrying these transgressions in my heart. I've sinned against you. You're the one I've sinned against. You're the one that I've done wrong. I've done an evil thing in your sight. But do something in me. Create a clean heart. Make me new. Make me right. And it's interesting because there's something about this unfairness, this life unfairness that stirs up shame in us, that stirs up somehow this feeling of, this is my fault. There's something about unfairness that when it happens, we almost have that, it's an ugly voice, and we don't usually tell people about it, right? It's that dark kind of thing that lingers, that somehow whispers into our ear, this is your fault. When unfairness happens, it's that little voice that whispers in our ear, you deserve this. You know what you've done. You can't fool anybody. You know who you are. This is your fault. And that shame becomes this heavy burden that we carry around with us. It becomes this weight that we lug around with us everywhere. I'm a huge fan of Brené Brown. If you've never heard her or read any of her books, she does a couple of TED Talks, and she talks about shame and vulnerability. She wrote some incredible books. She said, shame is the most powerful master emotion. It's this fear that we feel that says we're not good enough. And she actually quotes, I want to say it's the Jung, when she says, it's the swampland of the soul. She said, shame is the swampland of the soul. Because what shame does is it takes the focus and puts it all on us. Shame says, you're not good enough. Shame says, I know what happened to you. You're not smart enough. You're not talented enough. You're weak. Nobody's ever going to believe you. And it runs these two tapes in our head that we hear over and over again. That first one is the never good enough tape. So every life circumstance, everything that happens, our response, this shame trigger says, you're not good enough. And it loops through our head in our words and in our language and in our life experience. And then she said, if we're ever able to conquer that loop, we have the second one that's waiting right behind it that says, who do you think you are? Who are you? Who do you think you're trying to be? You can't kid anybody. And these loops run over and over and over in our head. And then what happens is there are a couple of things that grow shame. Secrecy. We don't talk about it. We work really hard to make it look like it doesn't exist. We work really hard to keep the secrets, the things that are our ugly gremlins that pop up in us. We don't want to talk about it. And we work really hard to protect it and keep it secret and keep it from anything that anybody knows. And silence grows shame because we try to keep it secret, because we refuse to talk about it. And judgment. We've been shamed by other people, and that feeling, that sick, I've been judged by somebody else, it all leads to growing shame. And here's the problem. When we feel guilty, we say, I've done something wrong. When we feel shame, we say, I am wrong. When we feel guilt, we're like, man, I did a stupid thing. Why did I do that? When we feel shame, we say, I'm stupid. And it gets lost. Guilt stirs up. Man, I need to apologize for what I've done. Shame says, you're just bad. Shame labels us as all bad. And it takes the I messed up to I'm a mess. It takes the I did a wrong thing to I'm wrong. And what happens is it ruins our definition of our very self. It robs us of the best version of who we're supposed to be. And it never speaks to our best version. We feel this shame, and that not good enough loop starts playing. Not, you can't do it all, you're not smart enough, don't look weak. And it mislabels who we are and who we're supposed to be. Look at what David said. He said, how long shall my honor be turned into shame? How long will you love vain words and seek after lies? Saying, how long will my best self be twisted and turned into shame? How long are these lies going to haunt me? You know, there's a reason they call shame a swampland, because it just drags us down, and it it's louder than the voice that says no. It's more convincing than the lie that says that's not all of it. You're more than just this. We start to believe it. We believe it when they say it, that loop goes through us. We believe that shame that stirs up in us, that feeling of we just can't escape. We remember the things that we've done. But there's an antidote. Brené Brown says that the only antidote to shame is empathy, because shame can't survive being spoken and met with empathy. And here's her suggestions for overcoming it. She says, number one, you got to talk to yourself like you talk to somebody you love. When we feel shame, what do we say? Oh my gosh, I'm stupid. I'm a jerk. I hate myself, right? Like all those ugly words. We would never talk to the people that we love that way. If my kids messed up, I would never say you're stupid. I would never say you're a jerk. I would never say to them those ugly words that we so freely toss around to ourselves. And yet we do. The ugliest voice we hear is usually our own. And so we set a standard that says, I'm going to talk to myself the same way I would talk to the people that I love most. And I would never allow the people I love most to be talked in this manner. And I'm going to do the same thing for myself. She said the second thing we do is we reach out to somebody that we trust, not just anybody. Not everybody is safe with our stories that we have to say. But there are some people that we trust, some people that we are safe with, and we share these moments. When we feel shame, we have people we turn to when we say, man, this is how I felt, and I don't like it. And we speak truth into what we feel. And then that part of it is telling our story. You got to talk about the things that we don't want to talk about. We got to talk about the things that we've been trying to keep secret so nobody can see that underneath the veneer is like this raging hot mess of a person. It's not easy, and it's not comfortable to stir up these emotions. But it's worth it, because shame can't survive being spoken to. Shame can't survive empathy. What it requires, though, is vulnerability, which is even more hard because we don't want to be vulnerable. We want to be tough and fierce and, right? What happens is we look at vulnerability in other people. We hear these incredible talks and these incredible life stories or these incredible interviews like Jewel did, and we see their vulnerability and it looks like courage. But when we're vulnerable, it feels like weakness. So in other people, vulnerability looks fierce and strong and courageous. In us, it feels weak. But I love Brené Brown said, vulnerability is our most accurate measure of courage. Friends, we weren't called to live lives of shame. We weren't called to live these lives that replace the honor we've been given by God with the shame that we feel at our life experience. In fact, Christ came to free us from that very feeling of shame. Christ called us out of the swampland and gave us a new hope and a new future in him. So this is how David responded. Look at verse 3. He said, but know that the Lord has set apart the godly for himself. The Lord hears when I call to him. When David focused on the unfairness of Ahithophel, the betrayal of his son Absalom, he felt shame. He felt the lies and the burden of their deceit, and all he saw was this unfairness of what he experienced. But when he shifted his focus away from these guys and these lies and these burdens, when he changed his focus, he was able to see beyond it. And he was able to remember, this is who I am in God. This is who God has called me to be. I am a man called by God. I am a man that God found, called by name and set apart. And stronger than even the shame that he experienced, stronger than even these lies that he was feeling burdened with, was this sense of God's calling in his life. And David was able to shift his focus from the shame and the unfairness back onto God. And when he did that, he was able to rise above the shame and the regret that he felt. And he was able to think about life different. Yes, I might be in the middle of some incredibly unfair circumstances right now, but that does not change. I am a man chosen by God. that does not change the truth that God spoke into my heart the day he called me by name and said, you are mine. And David was able to remind himself, I belong to God. I'm his son, his guy. And this refocusing his thinking changed everything. It reminded him of the work God was doing. It reminded him of the work that Christ was going to do. And friends, it reminds us that even when life is unfair, even when shame rears its ugly head in our heart and pulls us down into the swampland, we can shift the focus of our thoughts, that we are men and women called and claimed by Jesus Christ. That even when life is not the best circumstance that we want, even when it's disappointing and it hurts and we're burdened with the weight, we can remind ourselves we are sons and daughters of a holy God. We are the ones that God called by name and said, you are mine. David believed with all of his heart that he was a man set apart by God to do his good work. And he believed that God was listening when he called. He believed that God would hear his cries when he cried out to him. And believing this shifted his focus and kept him out of the mire of shame and in the light of Jesus Christ. The world tried to shame Christ when Christ was here in this world. They tried to take what was glorious in him and turn it into shame. They mocked him. They said, you know what? You're so good at healing other people. Why don't you heal yourself? They took his goodness and they mocked him for it. They said, why don't you call down angels to help you right now if you really are the Son of God? They taunted him. You said you would destroy the temple. What are you going to do now? They turned him into a gamble and gambled for his clothes. They hung a sign over his head that they could laugh at him and say, if you're really the king of the Jews, like that sign says, why are you hanging on a cross and dying? They tried to throw back what was best in Christ and shame him for it. But when the world tried to shame him, Christ's response was, he prayed to God and said, God, forgive them. They don't even know what they're doing. Isn't it incredible? When the world tried to shame Christ, when they tried to take what was best about him and turn it into shame, Christ prayed for them. He didn't hail down words of rebuke. He didn't say, you're going to get what's coming to you. He didn't scream karma. He prayed for them. He said, God, they don't even know what they're doing. Don't hold this ugliness against them. He took the mocking and the abuse and the ridicule and the disregard that they tried to lay at his feet, and he prayed to God on their behalf. The world tried to shame Jesus Christ, but he wouldn't be shamed. He would not be shamed by the deceit. He wouldn't be shamed by the lies. He wouldn't be shamed by the indignity of the cross. He wouldn't be shamed because he knew who he was, and he knew who God called him to be and put him in this world for. He knew his purpose, and he knew what he was doing. He knew that the result of this work, this sacrifice, this love, though misunderstood by those who stood and mocked at him and killed him, he knew it mattered. He knew it was the greatest gift the world would ever know, and he refused to be shamed by the ugly words of the people around him. He refused to be shamed, and he refused to be stopped. He endured all of it because his focus was on God, because his focus was on the work that he was doing in this world, and it was right, and it was good, and he would not be shamed for us. And he did it so that a day would come when all of us could call on the name of Jesus Christ and be saved. He did it so that a day would come where he's gone before us. He's prepared this wonderful place for us that one day we might be with him. He did it so that in our own moments of life, when the world tries to shame us, when our own regret and shame pops up, when our past gets ugly and the things that exist there, when they try to show up and claim our hearts, we are reminded that shame doesn't get the final say because my heart belongs to Jesus Christ. That in him, he gave me a new hope and a new name and a new chance at life. That shame and regret and pain and unfairness, they don't get to define my reality. They don't get to choose for me how I live my best life. That's already been given away to Jesus Christ. And his voice is greater and it is stronger than the ugly words that run on our loop. We are defined by the love and grace of Jesus Christ. We are defined by the work he's done in this world for us. And we gotta let his voice be louder. We gotta let his voice be stronger. We gotta let his loop run more clearly in our head than the loops of shame and regret. All right, so how do we do this? Let me give you a couple of tools that help us refocus and shift our thinking when unfairness and shame and regret come up. I read this incredible article in Psychology Today about how to deal with unfairness. And it said, you know, the people who do this well, it's not because it's easy, it's because they practice. It's because they've made it a habit in their life to practice and practice and practice and get better at responding to the things that come their way. All right, number one, we refocus, we deal with this unfairness by number one, taking a few deep breaths and asking ourselves, is it worth the energy that we're putting into it? So the first thing we do when we have that kind of ugly shame that pops up or that unfairness, that indignant feeling we have, the first thing we do is take a couple breaths and calm ourselves down. We have that human nature that immediately responds to something. It's like, this is unfair, it's crap, it's terrible, and we just launch a tirade. All right, before we do that, we calm ourselves down, we take a couple of breaths, and we put it into perspective. Okay, some jerk cut me off on the highway. Is the 15-minute raging rampage I'm going on really worth the energy that I'm putting into it? Somebody took my spot and now I have to wait an extra 20 minutes and I want to do, you know, a little bit of violence. Is it worth the energy that I'm expending into what's going on? Something incredibly painful and unfair happens and I can't change it. Is it worth the energy it sucks out of my life that I'm giving it? Is it worth the place in my life that I'm giving it? And sometimes it requires us to say, this isn't worth my stress. This isn't worth my energy. This isn't worth my attention. So we take a deep breath and we say, is it worth it? Is this really worth it? And then the second thing we do is we've got to be very, very conscious of what we can and what we can't control. I've wasted a lot of energy on things I have zero control over. We have no control over the choices of other people. If they would just listen to us, it would save a lot of pain, we know, but we have no control over other people's choices. We have no control about what somebody does or doesn't do. And if we can't control it, we can't expend energy and stress on it. The only thing we can control is how we respond. The only thing we can control is what we do with it. We can't change mistreatment that's happened in the past. We can't go back and undo it. It happened. We can't change that. But we can go forward and say, how do I address mistreatment that's happening right now? We can't change somebody's decision or their behavior if they're unwilling to change. But we can change how we respond to them. We can't change tragedies that have occurred. We can't step into the past and redo things that we don't like, but we can be champions for good now. We can say that tragedy occurred. What can I do so that a future one doesn't? And we can say, I get to choose what I put my energy on, what I can control and what I can't. And then the last one, the last suggestion they give is consciously monitoring negative thoughts and emotions. When we have negative thoughts, negative emotions, they don't always get to have free rein. We get to put up some little roadblocks in our mind that say, maybe I shouldn't do this to myself. Maybe instead of focusing on these negative things, these bad things, I shift my focus. I can't change what happened. I can't go back and make the past different. And nothing I feel is going to make that change. But instead, I can think about positive forward change. I can't go back in the past. So when these negative emotions come up, we're helpless. I can't go back and change it, but I can say, what can I focus on that's present? What can I focus on that pushes me into the future? So here are some questions to ask yourself when those negative emotions start filtering through. Is this thought or feeling positive or negative? This thing that I'm thinking right now, is it positive or is it negative? Is it something I have any control over? If yes, great. What can I do to change it? If not, how do I shift my focus on what I can? Is it something that's happened in the past? Is it something I can do now or in the future that might produce change? We can't give every thought, every emotion we feel free rein. Some we just need to say, stop it. We need to put up like a huge old roadblock sign that says, no. But we can practice these ideas and get better at controlling our thoughts and our emotions and the energy we put into what we have control over. I love because it said, being happy and doing things that make you happy is a choice. But so are being bitter, angry, vengeful, and miserable. They're all choices that we get to make about the energy that we put into our life because they're mindsets. And we get to choose our mindsets. We get to choose what we focus on and what we give our most attention. The very best lives that God's called us to live, it's just on the other side of this shame and unfairness that we feel. And we got to do the work to get ourselves out of that swampland and into the light of the life Christ has called us to live. We got to put Christ before us. We got to put our focus and our hearts and our minds on him because he's the one who gives us the courage and the faith to strive valiantly in this world. And he's the one who's claimed us. He's the one who's redeemed us. He's the one that we find hope for a better future, that gives us the courage we need to say, yes, life is unfair, but it doesn't always have to be this way. I get to be the very person Christ claimed when he called me by name. Dear Heavenly Father, I pray that you would be with us. I pray that you would hear the cries of our hearts. Father, what we bring with us today, the shame, the regret, the unfairness that we've been experiencing, would you help us, Father? Would you hear our cries as you heard the cries of David? Would you be with us and help us to shift our focus from what we can't change, from what we've messed up? Would you help us shift our focus to you, Father? Give us hope for the future. Remind us that we are your sons and daughters called to do your good work in this world. Would you please help redirect our hearts, our lives, and our thinking? Help us to focus on Jesus Christ. In his name we pray. Amen.